that way Peter de Schrijver is going to tell us a bit about porting and about issues you can encounter and how to solve them. So we'll all be able to help him and his colleagues with their efforts to port Debian to every little architecture that we support. Peter.
Okay, first, quickly introduce myself. My name and email address is on the slide, so that's okay. My job is mainly embedded systems work, mainly device routing and kernel porting. So in my day job I use a lot of not so well-known architectures, at least from a programming point of view, like ARM and MIPS, which is why I think some of my experience will be useful for all the Debian people to get their packages more in line with porting requirements. Space report. Yeah. I will a small overview of the of my talk. I will first describe why portability is important, and I will go on with a number of problems which occur in both user and kernel end code. Some C types which specific to some things which are specific to C programming, like the proper use of C types. Problems with bit fields and stuff like that, and some more general stuff like NDN as an environment, which also occurs in other programming languages. Then I will go on in how to access peripheral hardware. There is a number of tools and programs in Debian. I think XServe is the most well-known one, but there are others which directly access the hardware from userland. I will explain what sort of problems this implies and how this should be handled. So why do we require portability? Correctness is one point. I think it's a good goal to have to try to write correct code which adheres to standards and proper coding practices. Portability is porting software to other platforms is a way to exercise this adherence to the rules. As Tess already said, Debian claims to be the universal operating system. There's obviously no way you can claim that by only running on a single platform. Debian is also the most used embedded distribution. This comes from a survey which was done last year by Linux Devices, which is a website which focuses on embedded use of Linux. Actually, what they mean with this is that Debian is used a lot by companies to derive their own small distribution for their custom made for their device. There are very few devices which actually run a stock Debian installation. But still, they use the binaries. In some cases, we provide on their machines. There are also hardware advances like faster CPUs, more memory and stuff like that, which make Debian feasible on platforms we at the moment don't consider powerful enough to be able to Debian. One is, for example, mobile phones. If you consider that future phones will likely have 128 megs or more of memory, several gigabytes of storage, that's a platform and 500 megahertz processor. As a platform, which should be capable of running Debian. A few years ago, the desktops were probably not all desktops were that powerful already. The last reason is that it's quite fun and enlightening to work with other platforms and other architectures. It gives you a nice view on how computing can be approached from a different point of view. So we start off with the C types. There's a few basic rules which you can derive from the C standard specifications. Like there's a rule which says that the hard should always be smaller or equal than short, int, and long. But there are and the short and the int are all at least 16 bit. But there is nothing that forces a short, for example. There is nothing that says that an int has to be 32 bit, for example. It could also be 64 bit, so you cannot rely on this minimal size of an integer. Long is at least 32 bit according to the specifications. But most importantly, a point is not necessarily as big as an int. classical mistake made by all the Unix programs in which or all the Unix systems this was the case. And there were a lot of programs which pass an int as a parameter, and sometimes also use it to pass the same value to a pointer, which obviously fails if your pointer is bigger than your int, which is typically the case on the 64-bit platform like Alpha or AMD64. So, a few things to keep in mind. The C standard says int is normally a native register size in the sense that all operations are supposed to be fast on normal operations like addition, multiplication, shifts, are supposed to be fast on an int. So use those ints as much as possible for simple things like having loops or counters for array indices or whatever. It's not worth trying to size optimize your code by thinking, my loop counter never goes beyond 5,000, so I can use a short because it's guaranteed to be 16 bits, so it should always fit. Unfortunately, there are some architectures on which shorts are actually slower than ints because there are no instructions to directly manipulate a short variable. So the only way to do it is actually to fetch the whole 32-bit int and mask out the proper half word, which is significantly slower than actually using an int in the first place. If you have to do external communications with binary stuff, being either file, certain binary file formats and a certain binary network packets, which specifies the use of certain sizes, like this should be a 16-bit variable, it should be 32-bit. Then using the newer ESO C99 types, which actually allow you to say, this is an int which is unsigned and it's 8 bits, and you are always guaranteed it will be 8 bits. Same for 16 and so on. Like I said before, don't abuse to hash to save memory. Generally, it might even cost you more memory than you were trying to save. It's always helpful to use a recent GCC with all warnings enabled because it tends to be better at detecting this sort of problems than the older versions, especially suspicious pointer casts and stuff like that. Bitfields is a rather annoying problem. There are quite some file formats and packet layouts which require bitfields. You would be tempted maybe to use a C bitfield structure for that. But the problem is that the ANSI C standard does not tell you how a bitfield actually looks in memory. As you can see from this slide, I defined an example bitfield with two bitfields, one of 3 bits and one with 5 bits. On a normal Intel x86 CPU, it looks like the first half, so the first bitfield is in the lower 3 bits, the lower power will see the first 3 bits and the upper 3 bits. So depending on which architecture you compile, you will generate, or which architecture your program runs, you will generate different bytes, even though the sources are the same. Obviously, the other end will generally be unhappy about this. NDNS is probably the classical problem. So there is a 32-bit word, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And there are obviously multiple ways of splitting this into 4 bytes. And the little endian way is the way which is used on most ARM, Alpha, Intel, AMD64. And is start by the least significant bytes, so 78, 56, 35, 34, 1, 12. But obviously there are architectures like PowerPC, MIPS, and also ST90 which do it the other way around. This mainly matters if you write code which has external interfaces like files, because file formats and network packet layouts generally specify the MDNS. Most network protocols are big endian. There is obviously one major exception, which is SMB, which is due to its Microsoft heritage probably became little endian. And then I think stuff like HIF and JPEG is also mostly little endian. The usual way to deal with this is to have actually sort of macros like the kernel does this, which allows you to read or write a little endian 32-bit entity, and it will, depending on the platform you compile the code for, use do either bit swapping, byte swapping or not. So if you write a little, you say, I want to convert a little endian 32-bit number to the CPU, and CPU native endianness, and it's, you run on the internet, does nothing, and you run on a power PC, and it will be byte swaps. That allows you to write, to limit the code which needs to be platform aware to a very small header file, and instead of having to worry about this in your whole program. Alignment is another problem. Most CRISP processors actually require aligned accesses. What I mean by this is generally they require memory access to be aligned on the size of the access. So if you have a 32-bit access, it needs to be on a 4-byte aligned address. If you do a 16-bit access, it needs to be on a 2-byte aligned address. And if you do a 64-bit access, it needs to be on an 8-byte aligned address. If you don't do this, two things might happen. If you're lucky, this will actually be trapped by the kernel. The kernel will simulate the access for you, so it will actually fetch two words and combine the right bytes of both words to the thing you want to read. But obviously this is slow because you have to do a kernel trap, and the kernel has to do multiple memory access, combine the stuff, and then give it back to you. And also, it's generally not possible in kernel land. So that's, and on some architectures you can at least get nasty kernel messages. If you ever run some project DHCP clients on alpha and you enabled alignment warnings, you will have a kernel log full of messages. Obviously, underlined accesses are not atomic. What I mean by this is it cannot be guaranteed that it happens. That if you had two threads, two CPUs doing an underlined write to the same location, that you will have a consistent state afterwards. You might get half a word from one process and another half from the other process, for example. There are also RISC, I think RISC CPUs, and ARM is the most well-known example of this, which cannot cope with underlined accesses at all. You just get a wrong result. You don't even get a trap. In that case, obviously, it would just cause data corruption, which is bad. It's better to actually try to avoid aligned accesses as much as possible. This is not always possible, because sometimes you have to work with binary data which comes from somewhere external, which has unaligned entities, and then you have to work with them. And the best thing you can do that is then convert to an internal structure which is aligned and work on that. So try to convert between the underlined and the aligned world always as an I/O boundary. So if you read or write a file or send a frame or receive a frame, then convert it to an internal structure which is aligned, and vice versa if you to send it. If possible, it might be helpful to try to hint the compiler that you're doing an underlined access, so it maybe can optimize it by generating code which actually does what the kernel trap does, but then in user space, so at least you save the trap overhead. Obviously, it will still be not atomic, but yeah, I don't think there is a need for atomic underlined access, because atomicity is generally required for stuff which, for variables which you share between processes or threads, and they are always internal variables, so you should be able to do those aligned, and if they need updating from external information, you can do the alignment, the realigning before you actually go to the atomic data. The next bits will go on how I/O access to external peripherals. So with that external peripheral, I mean stuff which is not on, which is not part of the CPU core itself, works, and also what sort of pitfalls you can expect when you try to do this. To give a better explanation of this, I will first give some idea on how modern systems look like, so you have, and then go on with listing the issues and what stuff to avoid. I took two classical PC style art systems, because that's probably what most people are familiar with. What I call the Intel style system is a bit of the older Intel style system. Think of a Pentium 3, the Pentium 3 or early Pentium 4 era. So you have one or more CPUs which have a front side bus, which is, I'll show you. The front side bus is the bus connecting the two processors and the NOR bridge. The NOR bridge is sort of a central routing thing which allows accesses from the CPU towards the main memory, and also allows accesses from the CPU towards the devices, and the devices are generally connected via a PCI bus. So this bus underneath on the bottom end of the slide is generally PCI, and then devices you have on the PCI bus can, for example, your graphics cards, your audio card, your network chip. And one of them is generally what they call the salt bridge. And the salt bridge is generally used to bridge towards slower peripherals like serial port, PS2 ports, parallel port, if you still have those. Obviously the devices themselves on this end of the PCI bus can also access main memory. So that's what is generally denoted by bus masking. So for example, a network card can write an incoming frame directly in main memory, but can fetch a frame to be sent directly from main memory without the CPU having to write every single byte or word to the network controller. This obviously also goes for audio cards or graphics cards. So the main components we have is the CPU complex, which is one of more CPUs, which are generally in a symmetric, they call in the SMP mode. What they mean by this symmetric multiprocessing is that all CPUs have the same view on memory, are cache coherent, so if one caches something, the other knows it, or at least if it tries to access something which is out of date with respect to main memory, it will be notified. And they share the same bus. Then there is a NOR bridge, where I explained, which is the main major traffic routing thing between all the buses. There's a salt bridge and a memory subsystem. So the main interface we have is the front side bus, which links the processor complex to the NOR bridge, the PCI, which is used for most peripherals, and AGP, which is somewhat an improved version of PCI, in the sense that it has a second channel next to normal PCI bus. There is a second channel, which they call sideband channel, I believe, which allows requests to be sent out of band from the normal path. So you can actually queue at the next request while the current one is being processed. This is mainly used because on a normal bus like PCI, generally you have a turnaround times for if you do a read. If you do a read on a PCI bus, you first have to, the CPU, for example, first writes the address he wants to access. Then the bus, then there is some card which responds. Then the bus, there needs to be a little bit at settling time so that actually the other side can write the data back on the bus. Now this settling time obviously causes performance loss. So what they do with AGP is the graphics card sends the read request for the next things he wants to see during while the data of the current read request is being transferred over the other wires. Obviously this also limits AGP by definition to a single slot, so it's not really a bus, it's more sort of a link or parallel interconnect. The Opteron came into the picture a few years ago by now, I think. It's not only different because it was 64-bit and because it was AMD's push in the server market, there are also major architectural differences. As you can see on the picture, it's still a dual processor system. It can also be more processor, but for the example we look at the dual processor system. But the memory controller now moved inside the CPU. So we actually have two memory controllers, one per CPU, which also means that some memory is actually slower. The accesses to some memory have a higher latency than accesses to other memory. So the local memory is obviously faster than the memory which is connected to the other processor. I think I'm not sure how much difference there is in the latency, but I guess there must be a factor of, I think, 2 or 3 maybe. It's only the late. I think the latency is the biggest component which will increase due to the hypertransport link. There is another. These processors themselves are interconnected using hypertransport, which is a link and not a bus. So if you have more than 2 processors, topology changes obviously, and there are more hypertransport links. The advantage of having a hypertransport link is obviously that you don't have the problem with bus contentions. Then the second, the other I/O, so the other communication with peripherals is also handled via hypertransport. So generally there is a hypertransport PCI express in this case bridge, and then all the devices are connected to PCI express. Obviously modern Intel systems also switch to PCI express, so the Norbridge then has PCI express interface instead of PCI. Peripherals can obviously be connected to the other processor as well, and the same story about latency increase holds for if the left CPU accesses the device which is connected to a hypertransport PCI which is connected to the right CPU, there is obviously a higher latency involved than if it would do it to its own peripherals. So we still have obviously our processors, but we don't have a real Norbridge anymore. Instead of this, we have a hypertransport PCI Express bridge which links the PCI Express route to the processor. Generally, there are still PCI slots in the system, and they are bridges of PCI Express, so there's a secondary PCI Express PCI bridge. And if you still have a star bridge, then it's connected again after this PCI Express PCI bridge, so then you have a third level of bus bridging involved. The interface has changed. Instead of front side bus, we now have hypertransport. One of the advantages is obviously, like I said, that it's a link instead of a bus. Another advantage is that it's standardized. You can actually plug in other things than an Intel CPU in a hypertransport socket. Actually, AMD is now standardizing the socket on an electrical level. And there are already people who produced, for example, FPGA ports which can fit into a hypertransport socket. So this is not only allows for better scalability by removing the shared bottleneck of the front side bus, but it also allows for more variety in the system architecture without making board design, without requiring a new board for every change. PCI Express is involved, which is the newer version of PCI which uses serial links. I will go on and explain in the next slide why this move has happened. And PCI is still there for all the peripherals we already have and have not yet been converted. So what you can see from these slides is a few things. Why did the system architecture change between the ones we saw, the older Intel system architecture we saw and the newer Opteron system architecture? It's obviously that CPUs became much faster than memory. If you remember that, for example, 486 ran at 100 MHz maximum. A Pentium now runs at about 2 GHz. The Pentium 4 has come up to 3 GHz, I believe, but that was probably not such a good idea. Anyway, memory has become faster as well, but not by the same order of magnitude. The increase in memory speed has been much lower. The bandwidth of memory has gone up, and the bandwidth of buses has gone up as well, but latencies didn't keep the same pace, actually. If you look at how the latency of doing a single memory access on a DDR SDRAM or on an older fast page model, 8-O-RAMs, it's maybe a bit faster, like maybe 50% faster, but not a few times faster like the memory bandwidth. which means it becomes more and more important to do as much as possible in a single transaction. So never try to avoid single word or single byte writes, but always write an entire 16, 64, or maybe 64 bytes, or maybe a whole kilobyte, depending on what you can do. Then there is another problem. Parallel buses are become very hard to use at when the speed goes up, because the trace lengths have to be exactly matched, because you can only read something from the bus when all lines are stable, and obviously that depends on the length of the traces and stuff like that. So it becomes very complicated. So what did people invent to actually cope with these issues? First, caches were invented to actually keep frequently used data close to the processor on chip in fast memory. Burst mode transfers were introduced to use as much as possible, to get as much as work as possible done in a single transaction. DMA is a good way of achieving this, because you then can program a separate controller to say, I want to transfer so many bytes from this address to this address on the peripheral board, and it will handle it all by itself. The DMA controller can optimize the length of the transfers to increase bus utilization. And to cope with the problem of the parallel buses, people are moving to high-speed serial links. You can see this in PCI Express, for example, has instead of a 32-bit or 64-bit wide bus, it has has a number of lanes going up from one lane, which is at the moment up on, I think, 1.5 gigabit, and then go up to 3 gigabit to 4 lanes. But I think the one is
version 2 is now 5 gigabit.
Yeah. And that's not yet, well, it's standardized.
Yeah, it's officially now.
I'm not sure how many, I think most products are still on the
newer.
Anyway, there is a one, and if 5 gigabit is not good enough, you can bundle it to 4 and 8. I think 16. In theory up to 32, but I think the highest implementation is 4 to 60. This has the advantage that the serial links are easier to route them in these wide parallel buses. It's also better, it seems, from power management point of view, because you can actually turn off the transceivers when there is no need for them, and have a single line to wake up the other side if something needs to be transferred. The serial links are also full duplex, so while a classical PCI was standard was 33 megahertz, this means you could, in theory, transfer like up to about 100 megabytes per second if you're lucky. That's 100 megabytes, but it can be reached, but it's very hard. In general, you don't reach that high kernel speeds. And you have the problem, like I said, with the bus turnaround. So reads are significantly slower on PCI than writes. On PCI Express, we went to full duplex design, so there is a separate data path for reads and for transfers towards the device and transfers from the device towards the main CPU, which means that we don't have this read turnaround problem anymore. The reason the switch to serial links didn't happen before is, or at least one of the reasons, is that the necessary silicon to do this, or the necessary electronics to do this, became only recently feasible economically to actually integrate this on a chip. So that's why this trend hasn't started before. So a number of problems which we have, a number of side effects we see from this shift, is that some transactions can actually be reordered. This is mainly to improve bus utilization. For example, the PowerPC processor will reorder accesses to external memory to improve burst mode performance, but also bus bridges. If you have a bridge between PCI Express and PCI, or even PCI, can also can also reorder transactions in sometimes. The problem is obviously, for memory accesses is fine as long as the processor knows that if your CPU writes to two consecutive two memory locations and you read back from the CPU, it will obviously see the right result because it's in cache. The results will end up in memory in the end. But obviously, if the other end is a hardware peripheral and not memory, the order might matter. For example, if you have a hardware which wants to see a write on a certain address before another one, then you have to do them in the right order. And just ordering the instruction, writing the instructions in the right sequence is not enough to do that. Like I show in this example, there is a base register, is R31, which contains some sort of a base address. If you do a store word of R20 and R21 plus 0x20 hex offset, and then store R22, it might be that the hardware will actually do deals in the other way, in the other order than shown. So what they do is they invented a special instruction which is called EIEIO, enforce in order execution for IO. I think they came up with an explanation after they found a nice harmonic for this instruction. This EIEIO is a sort of a barrier instruction. If you execute that, you are sure that all pending stores are finished before the next instruction will be executed. So we are sure that this first store of R20 to 0x20 plus our base register will be performed before we go on. With bus bridges, obviously you can't just do that because they don't really have instructions. You only can communicate by them by doing accesses. So what you can generally do is read some address, because a read generally causes all outstanding writes in a bridge to be performed before actually doing a read operation. Then, as shown before, there are in general multiple entities which can write to main memory. We have our main CPU. We also have our PCI or PCI Express card. And obviously, if you have multiple entities writing to the same or accessing the same memory, you can have a problem with coherency, especially because the processor that has local caching, so it thinks it knows what's in memory, but maybe someone else using DMA has been overwriting. So there's no need for coherency. Some Intel systems do this in hardware, so if a PCI card writes to memory and the processor was actually at that location, not that memory location in cache, the processor will discard its cache and will read it next time you need the information. But this is called bus snooping. So the NOR bridge actually notifies of the processor, actually looks on the bridge and gets notified when someone else is also looking at writing memory. Or you can also have the other way around. If there is a location in cache, but it's not yet been written to memory, and someone else reads to memory, the transaction needs to be aborted, and cache write needs to happen first, and then the other bus master can try again. On some systems, this is not implemented, mainly on smaller MIPS. And also embedded PowerPC, and I think on ARM, I don't think there are even cache coherent ARMs, so I'm not sure about the ARM v6 processors. Maybe they have this. So you have to do this in software. The device driver has to realize, someone is going to do a DMA, or at least I program this card to do a DMA transfer, so I have to be sure that caches are flushed or written back, depending on the direction of the transfer. There are two ways of generally coping with this problem. Either you invalidate single cache lines or a number of cache lines, which is useful if you have a memory buffer which needs to be transferred, like a network packet or disk sectors or something like that, or some sort of streaming I/O. So you get data from one source, like an application or something, and then you have to send it to the outside world or the other way around. You get something from you get a network packet, you have to process. Then you have to send the data upstream. So to avoid as much memory copies you want, keep that block of data in the same physical location. And then it's advantageous. It's best to have to avoid copying to non-coherent to special memory. The other strategy is obviously to mark memory as uncacheable. The problem with this is that uncacheable memory is horribly slow because of this, because you can't use burst modes anymore. And also because the memory was significantly slower than than your cache, but it can still be useful if you have only if it's either data you almost never touch, like code which needs to be executed by the peripheral is in memory, sort of microcode. You copy it there once, you start the peripheral and you never touch the microcode anymore. So it doesn't matter, then it's not cacheable. Or sort of ring buffers where you constantly need access and just need to a few words, is generally better to have them not cacheable than. And there is the issue of addressing. There are three kinds of addresses in our system. We have virtual addresses which user generally sees. There is a physical address which is what appears on the CPU bus, and there is a bus address which is the address which appears on the bus. What I mean is that a PCI, an address on a PCI bus is not necessarily the same address as the one which is visible on the CPU. On the CPU address bus. There can be a translation. In the Intel world, this is 1-on-1, so basically all memory which has not been, all address space which has not been declared as being memory will be forwarded to PCI. But on some other systems, this is not true. There are various kinds of translations we can see. There is a translation from, there's a translation from physical to bus via identity map, that's the case I already covered. You can also have fixed offset, so the PCI address space leaves out PCI address 0 leaves a physical address 2 gigabytes, for example. It can be page table based, or it can even be non-memory mapped, which is like Intel I/O ports, for those who have low level still in Intel, you have these in and out instructions. So the best way to cope with this is actually always access hardware via special functions. And atomicity, if you have multiple processors or multiple threads, you obviously want atomic access. You also need atomic access in face of all the bus masters. There is obviously an issue if you have, like I said before, underlying accesses are never atomic, cannot be guaranteed to be atomic. If you want to do read, modify, write, which an read, modify, write operation needs to be atomic, you need CPU specific. You have, for example, Intel, you have lock, but on MIPS and Alpha, you have sort of a try and if it fails, catch principle. So you do a load, then you do something, you do a store, and then if the store returns like someone else looked at the location, what then you have to retry. Bus switches obviously may break your locks. You cannot guarantee atomic access on a PCI memory register. So what I want, this whole explanation is only to give you a hint on all the sorts of problems you encounter when trying to access hardware from your processor. You can obviously see, I think, that if you do this from user land, it's very problematic because it looks like you're addressing some virtual address and does something on your machine, and on Intel it will generally work, but on other architectures there is a high chance it will not work, or even worse, it will sometimes work and sometimes not work. So the solution to this problem is basically try to separate all the logic of your driver from command transport, and there are quite few nice examples already for doing this, like USB as libUSB, so you can do most of your USB device driver logic in user space, and then you give what comes out of messages, what comes in and out, goes in and comes out on messages, and they are just passed to the device driver, and that's on this actual transfer on the bus. So you don't have to cope with bus mastering, with other translations or whatever, you just give a message to the kernel, and the kernel makes sure that the device gets it. There's similar stuff for SCSI and Atapi commands where you can have a generic IOCTL like send this SCSI command to my CD writer, for example, or send this Atapi command to my CD writer. And again, the user does not have to worry about the details on how to actually get these bytes from main memory towards, from the main memory buffer towards the device. If you really have to do user land hardware access, I think you really need to provide some sort of an abstraction layer which can be changed by the people who need to port your code to something which is not an Intel processor. Yeah, I think, almost in time. So I'm not sure if there is still time for questions.
There's a break after this. So.
Yeah, okay. So I think if someone wants to know more or has questions, didn't understand everything or didn't understand anything, feel free here.
How can we let the compiler generate codes
for
alignments?
Most in C, you can actually, it mostly works as long as you have, if you have a struct and you flag it specifically with attribute packed, the compiler knows that it should not do any alignment operations, and it will actually, if you access a member of that struct, it actually knows that it's, and if the pointer is some fixed, otherwise it knows by beforehand, then it will actually do the right thing. But it obviously does not work if you, for example, if you allocate memory and then you add two to it and you cast it to this sort of structure, then it might fail. But for example, if you have a hardware, if you read something in a fixed buffer, then and you cast a struct on it and it has this magic pack attribute, you know that it's unaligned.
I should use aligned codes?
No, the code is always aligned.
I should use aligned data?
As much as possible, yes. Except if there is really a reason, if you really have to do the structure from the outside world, it's unaligned. For example, there are not some, actually most protocols are same, don't have unaligned accesses, but there are a few which are not, I think, SMB again is the master in breaking all the sanity rules. Because it has unaligned 16 bits, it seems. So it's not so much of a problem in some cases. I've seen DHCP clients which have the same problem. The kernel land is fixed by having a special primitive which says read this word, but maybe it's unaligned. So please check alignment first, and if it's unaligned, then do the recombination stuff. That's maybe another address. So you can easily check if an address is aligned, and you also know the size of the entity you want to read.
What is the advice to add to the code? Use the word packed?
Yeah. If it's structured, then use packed, and otherwise, if it's not structured, or you don't know if the base address will be aligned, then it's probably better. Yeah, it's better to check, to have a function which does something like read unaligned word, read underline 20, 32 bits, and then looks at the address and decides to either does a read or does three combinations. And on ARM you have to do this, because on ARM you don't have tabs. Although this might have changed with the new ARM ABI, so maybe the new ARM ABI does have tabs. But I'm not sure. I think they changed this.
It's not
it's only in Debian, but
yeah.
It will become at some point. At some point, it becomes an issue. Not yet. Yeah.
Two questions. One, just educational one. What exactly is meant by cache invalidate?
Cache invalidate, okay. But that's an interesting question, because it's a heavy abused concept. I generally say cache invalidate when you discard the data from the cache. So you basically say to the person, this data is no longer valid, don't write what's in your cache line, just discard it. And then there is cache flush, which means write back the data to where it belongs, and then,
If the line was dirty, you can't. You have to flush it first. Or
That depends on the direction of your transfer. If your bus if you have a network card writing to some memory, for example, a buffer, such stuff. You want to invalidate the cache, because whatever was before will be overwritten, so there is no point in writing it back.
But it probably was some useful data.
No, I mean, if you allocate a buffer, and then you say to a network card, please write my next packet into that buffer, was hopefully no useful data.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's gone now.
Okay.
So then it makes sense to say, forget about the cache, is no longer useful. Obviously, if it's the other way around, if you want to send something, you point the network out to your buffer. I want to send this buffer, then you want to be sure that the data you've written there is
okay.
actually in memory. And then you want to flush
okay,
to write back the memory to file, write back to cache like in memory.
The second one was the status of EABI and soft float support for ARM.
That's the new ABI
it's there is a yeah, that's the new ABI I was just talking about. I got it that there is a port that there is a whole number of packages
yeah,
built for it, but I'm not sure how many of them. Or
well,
what fraction of the other
parts they have mostly working on.
Yeah.
One guy who's been testing
with
Spark.
Yeah, so it works.
It actually works. They need now mostly what I understand is that they need a transition plan to be able to replace the ABI, the current ABI with the EABI.
So it's going to be standard for which release? Or
I can't really say anything about that, but I hope it will be ready for them.
Let's hope it's the next release.
I hope, yeah, not for actual.
The problem is, I don't think it. I believe the AABI is not compatible with all ARM processors.
Yeah, also.
So there are a few older ARM CPUs that not be used in AABI.
Yeah, it's problematic, yeah.
I think everything is probably 4 or 5.
It's 5 something, or later.
Yeah, it needs to
it's not all 5.
For some bizarre reason, I don't know myself. What I think will happen is that we will have maybe not forever, but I think at some point there will be a point where we'll have both. Because we need to have both platforms and not all the support as well. More problems, questions? Feel free to.
Thank you, Ben. We have now a short break and then...